Good morning. Good morning. Did you get a handout, Tim? Yeah, it's sicker this time. Okay. We're going to take off this morning when everybody's ready. I guess I could find a quiz. Ooh. I don't have one for today. Okay. Okay, the next handout is available. Some people accuse it of being a book. It's thick. One of the things that you will notice, though, is that it's organized by disease. And the other thing that you will notice is there's a fair amount of redundancy within the handout itself. So when beta blockers are important for angina, they're discussed again. When they're discussed as an antiarrhythmic, there's a section on that. When there's antihypertensives and you're using the same drugs as you've seen before, they're repeated. The advantage of doing that is it's repetition for you. So as you repeat it more and more, hopefully this vocabulary course that you're in will begin to make a little more sense. And so it's a little bit thicker than it probably needs to be because of the repetition. However, I think it makes it easier for you. This morning we're going to take off. We're going to cover angina and congestive heart failure. And one of the things that I did notice with especially the congestive heart failure chapter is your two books almost talk as if they're two different strategies for treating it. And there are different drugs that are available, and how you start and what you add on is variable. And so depending on where you train and who you train under and that sort of thing, you'll get different biases. When we think of angina, most people think of the crushing chest pain that people have. They think of the fact that there's an accumulation of metabolic waste. The heart's not getting rid of the waste products that it produces. It's not getting adequate oxygen to produce the work that it needs in order to pump the heart, the blood out of the heart. And so when we think about angina as a very simplistic look, we really have an imbalance between oxygen supply and oxygen demand. And so pharmacologically, you want to try to manipulate the system so that you can enhance oxygen supply or you can reduce oxygen demand. So when we think about this, we can look at the overall scheme of things and see what all's involved. From a standpoint of oxygen supply, you can increase it by increasing regional blood flow. So you can see here that nitrates, CCBs, or calcium channel blockers, and beta blockers all have an impact to increase blood flow to the heart. In terms of oxygen extraction, there's a compound, it's called quercetin, it's isolated from saffron, that is great at enhancing oxygen uptake by cells. Now, the last time any of you went to the store and bought saffron for saffron rice, you probably realize it's really pricey stuff. So imagine anything that's extracted from it. But there is an effort being made to develop compounds that actually will aid oxygen extraction by tissues. The other area of impacting oxygen supply is going to be with coronary blood flow directly. You can increase it with nitrate class of drugs or with the calcium channel blockers. So pharmacologically then, you can augment oxygen supply. Of course, there are other drugs that could be used that might diminish oxygen supply. So things that would cause coronary artery vasoconstriction, would it be a deleterious agent? Now on the flip side, how do you affect oxygen demand? Starting at the very simplistic approach, preload and afterload changes are going to affect oxygen demand. So preload can be decreased by nitrate drugs. Afterload's decreased by the calcium channel blockers. And so we can affect the amount of blood that's going back to the heart. We can also affect the pressure against which the heart has to pump. And obviously you realize that things like beta blockers are going to affect heart rate, cardiac contractility. And so we've got the mechanisms in place then, the drugs in place to manipulate the system. Just as a factoid, the heart extracts about 75% of the oxygen that's presented to it. So it's a high demand organ. If you affect supply, then you're going to have an impact on demand. So what are some factors that can influence a reduction in oxygen delivery to the heart? Well, most everybody thinks of classic angina pectoris. In terms of classic angina, you're basically dealing with a situation of obstruction. So as you can see in the very top portion of this figure, you've got a lesion in place right here, and that's going to reduce the amount of blood that can get through this part of the coronary artery. And when we think of forms of angina, this simple obstruction is classic angina pectoris. So in this situation, you can actually think of it this way. It's exercise induced. There's usually no chest pain at rest. You typically see a depression in the electrocardiogram of the ST segment. And in over 95% of the cases, there is a fixed lesion present. So atherosclerosis then has a major impact on classic stable angina. Okay. The second form that we can think of, so here you see, I've lost it. Okay, so the second thing that we can think of would be that form of angina that's caused by vasospastic problems. Vasospastic problems can be caused by a number of things. A lesion could contribute to frank vasospasm. In other words, that part of the tissue now is more rigid than the rest of the tissue around it, so when you stimulate part of it, you get an awkward response. The other thing that could be happening is that the tissue is just now hyper or hyposensitive to stimuli, and so you get vasospastic disease. In terms of vasospasms, we're usually dealing with what's called variant angina. Down here in the bottom, variant angina. Some books will call it Prince Metals angina. Rarely is anginal pain induced on exertion. It's more common at rest. You tend to see an increase in the ST segment, and most of the time, vasospasm is the component that's important. So 25% lesion plus spasm, 75% is just spasm alone. I don't know that the numbers mean anything, but the point being is that with classic stable angina, the biggest problem is due to having an atherosclerotic lesion in place, occluding blood flow just by simple mechanics. In the case of variant angina or Prince Metals angina, you're dealing with a situation where vasospasm, reversible spasm of the arteriolar wall, contributes to a reduction in blood flow. I haven't talked about unstable yet. So hang on a second. So is the distinction between stable and variant clear? Okay. In unstable angina, you've got a a more complicated situation. It can be exercise induced. You can have anginal pain at rest. You can see increases and decreases in the ST segment. There can be lesions, 40% lesion, 50% lesion plus spasm, or 10% of the patients will have spasm alone. In terms of unstable angina, this is really beginning to herald an imminent MI. So the person's not dealing with things very, very well. So the point of thinking about subtypes of angina is that you've got either an obstruction to flow caused by some kind of a fixed lesion, or you've got less flow because of the muscle spasming and contracting at inappropriate time, inappropriate amounts. Does that answer your question, Sean? Okay, Heather?
With the ECG, with the ST segment, if you see an increase, is it possible that you can also see the decrease within one ECG, or you're going to see either or? Like either or?
My understanding is, and I'm welcome for correction, but my understanding is a patient will show one direction, but another patient may show the opposite direction. But it's not that the patient's flip-flopping. Yes, sir? Right here, 40% lesion. And again, these numbers aren't cast in stone. 50% lesion plus spasm. And about 10% of your patients will have spasm alone. Okay. One of the other things that should be mentioned as well that can cause obstruction might be platelet aggregation or a thrombus being formed. So it could be that the platelets could hit an atherosclerotic plaque that could trigger aggregation, and as they begin to stick together, then what happens? You reduce blood flow to that particular region. So transient platelet aggregation, coronary thrombi can contribute also to angina. So how do you treat it? Well, almost everybody can think of CABG procedures, coronary artery bypass grafting. You can also think of PTCA, percutaneous transluminal coronary angioplasty with stenting. So surgery is one way to treat angina. Percutaneous transluminal coronary angioplasty. With stenting most commonly. And so what's surgery trying to do? Increase blood flow to that particular region. What else might be done? If you think of dietary type changes, a patient might be asked to reduce cholesterol intake, fat intake, things of that nature, trying to help reduce the laying down of atherosclerotic plaque. In a patient with anginal pain, you tend to start statins when their LDL is greater than 100. So you might put them on statin therapy. Since platelet aggregation and thrombus formation can play a role, aspirin would be an appropriate thing to do. So 85 milligrams to 325 milligrams of aspirin a day could also be done. So that's kind of the general. What about more specifically? What can we do? Well, there are a number of drugs that can be used, and we're going to get into those. What's the goal of therapy? The goal of therapy is going to be able to bring that balance between oxygen supply and oxygen demand back into an optimal range. So, yes, sir. Depending on the degree of anginal difficulty, exercise may be something that needs to be restricted and light at the beginning before you get very aggressive at it, because you can push them over the edge. So you can't just say, go exercise. You've got to have them start at an appropriate level, and it's usually best to do something in a clinic that understands an anginal patient and what exercise can do. But yeah, exercise has an impact too, for the good. So there are lifestyle changes. There's another lifestyle change beside exercise. What's that? No smoking. You ever tried to get somebody to quit smoking?
And my dad did after he had a heart attack. So
that's quite a wake-up call. Yeah. So lifestyle changes can be very, very difficult, but they do play a major role in the treatment of angina. Okay, but what about drugs? Everybody'd rather pop a little pill, right? What can we take? Well, the first class of drugs that we can talk about are the nitrates. We've got this little case history here. We got a 75-year-old uncle. He's got classic angina. It's brought on by exertion. He says he can prevent his chest pains by avoiding walking up the stairs or anything else active for that matter. If pain occurs, he sits down and places one prescribed tablet under his tongue. The tablet rapidly dissolves, creating a local burning sensation. He then notices a headache and a flushed sensation. And 2 minutes later, his chest pain and pressure resolve. So, what drug did he take? Nitroglycerin. And this is a fairly common type response for people who take sublingual forms of nitroglycerin. The intense vasodilation that occurs under the tongue creates that burning sensation. Within seconds, they begin to have a headache and feeling flushed in the face. And the good news is if they're having chest pain, it normally resolves very, very quickly. So the nitrates have a great place in this process, but they're not foolproof.
So if the brain is on an intense headache, is it contraindicated to keep your mind rest?
I don't know. I've never seen anything about that. But it, yeah, but it's better to deal with a migraine than it is a no heart. So I don't know. But that brings to mind a good point, and that is you've got other drugs to choose from to treat angina with. So if you know you got a person with migraine problems, and maybe the nitrates aren't the best problem. The other issue, though, is the nitrates are fairly short-acting, so it may be that you can get them through the anginal episode without having to precipitate a headache. I don't know. Nitrates, what do they do mechanistically? They work through nitric oxide. So nitric oxide ends up activating guanylyl cyclase, cyclic GMP increases. In the process, it ends up dephosphorylating myosin light chain, and you end up with relaxation then of the vascular smooth muscle. The nitrates decrease both preload and afterload. So they can reduce your pressures quite nicely, reducing the strain on the heart and the need for oxygen to work. What are some of the drugs that are available? Well, we've got nitroglycerin. Nitroglycerin comes in all kinds of forms. You can get it as a sublingual, you can get it as a patch, you can actually get it as an oral active agent. When we think of sublingual, onset is on the order of seconds to minute. Durations are going to be shorter, maybe 60 minutes. With the patch, you may get 12 to 14 hours out of it. So the formulation then has an impact on how long a therapy you can get. One of the things to remember about sublingual dosing, and this is also true with respect to rectal administration of, say, suppositories or dermal application of drugs, is that you avoid any first-pass clearance. So first-pass clearance is avoided with sublingual dosing, rectal dosing, dermal dosing. Okay, that was an aside. So what about other nitrates? Isosorbide dinitrate, isosorbide mononitrate. Imdur, I-M-D-U-R, seems to be more commonly used by a number of the docs at the hospital than the dinitrate. And I don't know why. So I think it's just personal preference and experience. But I think they're fairly similar. The isosorbide dinitrate does come in a chewable prep, though, which is one different form. The last agent on that list is amyl nitrite. Now, amyl nitrite's a little different beast. It's not used in angina, but this is the only other place in the course where you're probably going to see it. So what do we do with amyl nitrite? Turns out amyl nitrite can be used to generate methemoglobinemia, which can trap cyanide in cyanide poisoning. It's another nitrite, if you will. It's a nitrite. It's a vasodilator. It reduces preload. It reduces afterload. But it's really not used for angina. Okay. There's another mechanism that is important with the nitrates. It turns out that when you alter the cyclic GMP levels, you actually can decrease platelet aggregation. So there is a decrease in platelet aggregation as a result of increasing cyclic GMP. But the primary action is going to be through vasodilation. Okay. When are the nitrates used? Nitrates are used on classic or unstable or variant angina. A patient that has acute attacks that are of an episodic nature might do well with just having some nitroglycerin around. They take it on an ad-need basis. And some people get along for a long time, years, with that. But then there gets to the point where it becomes bad enough that they have to go on to long-term therapy. And that's where your other forms of presentation would be better, oral or patch or switching agents. What are the side effects of the nitrates? Well, I've listed orthostatic hypotension. Obviously, if you got that much vasodilation going on, that becomes a problem. And in my language, postural and orthostatic are basically synonymous. There's almost always a reflex tachycardia and a headache. Since we've got this weird beast, amyl nitrite, included in the list. Amyl nitrite's a little different. In terms of its side effects, you see methemoglobinemia. And you remember what methemoglobinemia is? Met, yeah. Did I misspell it? With methemoglobinemia, the iron is ferric. It's oxidized to the plus 3 state. So it makes nice for binding cyanide if you want to treat cyanide poisoning. Otherwise, the side effects are just the same as the nitrates. What's the problem with the nitrates? Tolerance. Patients get used to having the drug on board. It ceases to be active. Some mechanisms. Some people think, well, there's a lack of sulfhydryls in the cells, so glutathione levels and mixed disulfides get reduced. There's a desensitization of the guanylyl cyclase. That's probably more important. There are other mechanisms that have been proposed. Probably in your perspective, who cares? The bottom line is that the drugs can only be used for so long, and then the patient has to have time off. And the general rule of thumb is you need about 10 hours free of the nitrate in order to keep a therapeutically active drug. So what tends to happen is that people will put on the patch in the morning, they will take their oral dose in the morning, and then at bedtime, no more drug. And if you're treating classic stable angina, which is an exercise-induced angina, then usually that makes the most sense. You're going to give them the drug when they need it during the day so that they can function at a higher physical activity, and taking the drug away at a time when they need less muscle work, less oxygen delivery, and that sort of thing to tissues. So nitrate tolerance limits the usefulness of the class of drugs. And the only way you can get around it is to give the patient some time off. There is a school of thought that says that you can give N-acetylcysteine, which is mucomist, to try to replenish cellular sulfhydryls. If you do that, you can push the nitrate longer. But it doesn't work for everybody. So typically then, most of the time, your patient's going to have time away from the nitrates so that they'll be effective the next day. Okay, any questions about nitrates? Potent vasodilators, reduce preload and afterload. They also decrease platelet aggregation.
Are nitrates contraindicated in myocardial infarction? I don't know if I heard that somewhere.
You mean after the MI?
Yeah.
I don't know, but I haven't read that. Okay. What about a different scenario? We got this case here. We got a 57-year-old construction worker. He's a heavy smoker. He has pressure behind the retrosternal area. He has a couple of episodes a week. When questioned about the discomfort, he says it only occurs when he's working. It disappears when he rests. And it doesn't radiate to his left arm or jaw. It's never lasted more than 15 minutes. Except for a blood pressure of 150 over 100 His exam results are normal. So, what are you going to do in this situation? Treat the hypertension. So when you've got patients that have angina and other diseases, it's usually best to treat the other disease first, because oftentimes the angina will resolve. In this kind of situation, beta blockers are effective. Four are approved by the FDA for angina. But if you read current medical diagnosis and treatment, it'll tell you that all beta blockers appear to be effective anti-anginal agents. So, what do we know? Beta blockers reduce heart rate, they reduce force of contraction. So when you think about it, workload's going to go down, oxygen demand is going to go down. So that's helpful. With long-term therapy, beta blockers will reduce blood pressure. With the reduction in preload and afterload, you again are going to end up reducing the workload on the heart. So we can see effective use then of beta blockers in classic stable angina. But what happens if you've got a patient who's complaining of anginal pain and you give them a beta blocker and you make it worse? What do you think the cause of the angina is? So it's vasospasm and probably not obstruction. So beta blockers are not really good in vasospastic angina. Beta blockers are not really good for acute attacks. You got to have the drug on board before the attack occurs. So beta blockers have some limits, but beta blockers are the only anti-anginal drugs that will prolong life or prevent sudden death after an MI. So that being said, then if a patient does have an MI, then which class of drugs would be the most appropriate to use? It would be the beta blocker. And so there are a number of studies out there that have demonstrated that the beta blockers really do prevent sudden death post-MI. So it's here's their use. Here's their special niche, if you will. Beta blockers are prophylactic treatment for classic angina. They can be an adjunct to nitrates to block reflex tachycardia. So if the patient's not doing well enough on the nitrate by itself, or they have major problems with reflex tach, you can give the beta blocker to overcome that. But if the angina gets worse, what do you need to remember? Vasospastic disease. Okay. What are some side effects of beta blockers? There's a list down there, but you should know all these. So obviously, beta blockers come with their own baggage, and so you've got a risk-benefit situation to think about. So side effects, contraindications are both listed below. There is a third class of drugs that we can talk about that get a fair amount of use, and this is in vasospastic disease. And these are your calcium channel blockers. Now, there's a huge grocery list on the handout. So when the calcium channel blockers came out, everybody wanted their drug approved for angina, and that's pretty much what happened. So how do you control vasospasm? Vasospasm is due to muscle contraction. Muscle contraction requires calcium. So if you simply block calcium channels and inhibit the formation of calcium calmodulin complex, you can prevent the activation of myosin light chain kinase and you prevent muscle contraction. So you're turning the contractile process down, and that makes sense. So they block voltage-dependent calcium channels. Less intracellular calcium, less vascular smooth muscle contractility. What happens to preload? Decreases. What happens to afterload? It also decreases. Calcium channel blockers have an itty-bitty antiplatelet effect also. So what do we know about the pharmacology of the calcium channel blockers? Well, first of all, you'll notice that there is a whole slew of drugs that end in PINE. These are called dihydropyridines. And on the bottom, on the left, right-hand side, you've got the side effects then of the dihydropyridines. These are all of the calcium channel blockers that end in PINE. They are strongest, have the most affinity for vascular smooth muscle. They are good vasodilators. And so if you think about that, if you've got great vasodilation, what's a potential side effect? Reflex tachycardia. And so that's on the list as the first side effect. On the other hand, you got three others. These are different. So we've got diltiazem, bepridil, and verapamil. What's different about them? These three drugs all decrease heart rate. So bepridil, diltiazem, and verapamil. So the side effects are listed on the left-hand column at the bottom of the page. They decrease heart rate. They decrease myocardial contractility. Verapamil has the greatest affinity, if you will, for the heart relative to vascular smooth muscle. Diltiazem's about the same. And then you got the dihydropyridines, which have the greatest affinity for the vascular smooth muscle and limited effects on the heart. Now, it turns out that bepridil is a weird case. It's also a sodium channel blocker, and it's used as an antiarrhythmic. So bepridil can be used as an antiarrhythmic. So when you think of calcium channel blockers, you're going to have to think two groups of drugs. You're going to have to think the dihydropyridines, which reduce blood pressure, cause reflux tach, and then verapamil and diltiazem predominantly, which reduce cardiac contractility and heart rate, but still function as calcium channel blockers. Yes, sir. I know they block the plasma membrane channels. I don't know about the other. Yes, sir.
Is there any off-label use for hypertension?
Most are approved for hypertension also. A lot of use in hypertension. Okay. So angina then can be used or can be treated with, so far, nitrates, beta blockers, calcium channel blockers. What's the problem with the nitrates? Tolerance. What's the problem with the beta blockers? The vasospasm. Okay. If we go to the next page, we have a little discussion of aspirin. What do you remember about aspirin? It's an irreversible inhibitor of cyclooxygenase, binds to a terminal serine. It acetylates the alpha amino of the terminal serine, if you really want to know. Probably don't need to write it down. So it prevents prostaglandin and thromboxane production in platelets. This is a low-dose effect, which is why they talk about a baby aspirin a day or just a 325 milligram tablet, but don't take the extra strength stuff. We'll talk more about that later. So aspirin, used to treat unstable angina. May be beneficial in stable angina as well. Now, based on what you know about aspirin, what are its side effects? Prolonged bleeding time. At this dose, a lot of people complain about aspirin eating up the gut and stuff like that. You know, not at this dose. One tablet a day is not going to do it. How long is the duration of action of the drug? It inhibits cyclooxygenase for the life of the platelet. So it's an irreversible inhibition. So again, when you think of aspirin, you're thinking of unstable angina, especially. And you can use it probably in stable angina as well. Side effect, prolongation of bleeding time. Okay. The next drug on the list is dipyridamole. It turns out that dipyridamole is a vasodilator that also inhibits platelet aggregation. So we're going to talk about it later when we talk about its vasodilating properties. So you'll see it again. So that's one action, or two actions, I guess. Vasodilation, inhibition of platelet aggregation. And a third one, which some people argue is the most important of all, and others say no, it turns out that it inhibits adenosine uptake. So what does adenosine do in the coronary arteries? You guys don't know? It's a vasodilator. So it's a coronary artery dilator. And so if you give dipyridamole, you inhibit the uptake of the adenosine. If you inhibit the uptake of the adenosine, you prolong the action of the adenosine, so you prolong the action of a coronary vasodilator. And so that's good. Dipyridamole is really only used to treat unstable angina, unless it's put in a combination with other things. All right. So what about combinations, since I mentioned them? What sounds like a rational combination? Nitrates plus beta blockers. So you know you're going to have reflex tack with the nitrates. The beta blockers can prevent that. You can combine nitrates with calcium channel blockers. But when you do, which calcium channel blockers might you use? Or which ones would you not use? You would not use the dihydropyridines. Why is that? Now you got two drugs that are both causing reflex tack. Bad idea. So you can use verapamil. You can use diltiazem. So that's a rational use. It turns out aspirin can be used with all of these guys. And basically, there are people that say everybody ought to be on a baby aspirin a day, especially once they hit 5-0. All right. What about concomitant disease? If you read through that chart down at the bottom of the page, you'll notice that with most diseases, you've got options. So your hands aren't tied. If you've got a recent MI, calcium channel blockers are not the best choice. If you've got asthma or COPD, they tend to suggest not to use the beta blockers, which you should understand why. And with diabetes, same thing. You should not use the beta blockers, but you should understand why. Yes, ma'am. You could. I mean, you can use them. It's not like you can't use them, but you just need to think about it. The other thing to think about, and we've already mentioned this, if you've got these other problems, you want to treat the other disease first and see how the angina progresses or resolves. So treat hypertension first. Treat congestive heart failure first, and so forth. All right? Any questions? You need a break. I need a break. Well, let's get going again. All right. Let's think about congestive heart failure now. One of the things that's kind of interesting is there's a heart stocking that's being developed to try to just wrap the heart in to make it a little stronger. And apparently it's kind of a breakthrough technology. Whether or not it'll be out by the time you guys are practicing, I don't know. But it seems to be moving along. But the point of this is that congestive heart failure for years and years and years was called dropsy. So if you go back in history, there's really been very little that people could do for it. Oh yeah, they had their teas and they had different things that they would take for it. But when it comes to manipulating a weakening heart, there are lots of different drugs that you can throw into the system to help. But each one of those drugs comes with some baggage. And so if you could come up with a mechanical device, it might work. It might be easier to use than one of drugs where you're constantly balancing one drug against another. But at any rate, when we think of heart failure, what do we need to think about? We have a situation where there's typically a decrease in cardiac output. And that decrease in cardiac output leads to all kinds of changes. So if you just think of the venous pressure, volume, and things of that nature, then you can have congestion and edema developing. You can have breathing difficulties, especially paroxysmal, nocturnal breathing difficulties. One of the things that's clear is that when we're dealing with venous side-related issues and fluid-related issues, then vasodilators and diuretics come into play. And so there's a system that can be used. There's drugs that can be used that make sense. On the other side of things, you can have drugs that act directly on the heart to increase the force of contraction, so positively inotropic drugs. And so these are acting specifically on the heart to try to increase cardiac output. But if you've got a decreased cardiac output, then you can have decreased tissue perfusion. So most patients complain of fatigue and weakness as a result of a decrease in perfusion. The neuroendocrine system gets kicked in. You affect both the sympathetic side as well as the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system. If you start affecting the hormonal side, you end up with aldosterone going up. Aldosterone causes water and salt retention, and so you get more fluid then, so sodium and water retention. This fluid then contributes to the congestion and edema. So you can see that in terms of the renin-angiotensin system, we've got two classes of drugs that are effective. We've got the ACE inhibitors, which prevent the conversion of angiotensin 1 to angiotensin 2. But we've also got the angiotensin 2 receptor blocking drugs. So those go in with this as well. If the sympathetic nervous system kicks into overdrive, then you can have too much vasoconstriction, so vasodilators can be effective there. So when you think of right-hearted failure, you tend to think of congestion where? In the periphery. If you're thinking of left-hearted failure, you think of pulmonary congestion. Okay. So let's review some cardiac physio. When we look at this figure on page 9, what's the first thing that you think about? Cardiac physiology, okay. And what's the most important ion that you really are going to worry about? Calcium. Why is calcium so important? Because it's involved in muscle contraction. So it turns out that if you want to turn on contraction, you've got these voltage-sensitive calcium channels that allows calcium to come in from outside the cell. That's your trigger calcium. So that's the calcium that comes in and triggers the cell internally to release calcium from the sarcoplasmic reticular stores. You might think of this as your activator calcium. All that calcium being released into the cytoplasm then triggers the contractile process. And then the cell begins to try to say, okay, wait a minute, we got too much going on, so let's get rid of the calcium. So there's a sodium-calcium exchanger, which is involved in that. You pump the calcium out by bringing sodium in, and the sodium-potassium ATPase then comes back and says, wait a minute, we got too much sodium, so let's extrude that and pull potassium in. So you've got a complex system involving these different ion channels. And we've got drugs that affect the calcium channels. We've got drugs that affect the sodium-potassium ATPase. And there are experimental agents that can be used to affect the sodium-calcium channel. So, we can manipulate the system in several ways. The next page talks about compensation. It is possible in many patients to have a compensated heart failure where the system kicks up a little bit and then the patient's able to continue with normal life function without any trouble. When you think about that, what might be some of the things that would happen? This is a nasty figure, but that's, you know. So what's the first thing, the problem? The problem is going to be a reduced cardiac output. Okay, blood pressure is going to go down. The sympathetic system's going to, or the baroreceptors are going to kick in to say, wait a minute, pressure's too low, so that'll increase sympathetic tone, which will help compensate for the heart. So increased heart rate, increased force of contraction should increase cardiac output. But at the same time, you're also going to get an increase in vasoconstriction. So blood pressure is going to go up. That should increase afterload, which is going to cause the heart to work harder. So you can actually push from compensation to decompensation if this afterload gets too high. But the baroreceptor reflex is very important in terms of trying to compensate for the reduction in cardiac output. And we've already mentioned then the renin-angiotensin system. So you get aldosterone released from the kidney, you get angiotensin getting converted by ACE to angiotensin II. We get vasopressin being involved. We get an increase in norepi from the terminals. So there's a lot of different things that are going on that we're going to talk about drugs to manipulate the system. Okay. At the bottom of that page, you can see, I don't have a transparency of it, you can see the typical curve of stroke volume versus fiber length. You got the normal curve at the top with a reduction in cardiac output curve down below it. I guess I better slow down. Everybody's trying to color code the previous figure. Kristen? Orange is the renin-angiotensin-aldosterone system. So the two compensation systems are renin-angiotensin-aldosterone for one and the baroreceptors for the other. That's this part. For those of you without a colored pen, would you like to borrow one? Okay. Well, I'm going to talk and you can continue. In that very bottom part of that page, you'll see that there are a number of drugs that are used and what they ultimately are trying to do is they're trying to take that failing heart starling curve and push it back up toward where the normal curve would be. And so you can do that by changing things like blood volume, which has an impact to decrease fiber length if you decrease volume. So one is simply a diuretic response. Two kind of shows a typical ACE inhibitor response, so you get a reduction in blood volume, as well as a reduction in workload on the heart. With three, you got the positive inotropic agent trying to increase output as a result of more efficient use of the heart itself. Number four is just a pure positive inotropic drug, so dobutamine, and five of the cardiac glycosides. So we're going to talk about those as we go through this. But now, let's get some definitions out of the way. So if you're on the next page, what do you remember about preload? What's a typical preload value? Atrial pressure runs about an itty-bitty number, 15 millimeters of mercury or something like that, or less than that. When atrial pressure gets above 25 millimeters of mercury, you tend to have an increase in pulmonary resistance. Salt restriction is often mentioned as a very important aspect of therapy. The RDA, I believe, is 2.4 grams of sodium per day. In other words, 6 grams of sodium chloride a day. In salt restriction, you're supposed to be less than 1.5 grams of sodium. So there is a reduction then of sodium. If you typical processed food in America, you get a lot of salt. How many of you like your V8? I could have had a V8. How much salt's in one of those? A lot of salt. Tomato juice is the same. Yes, ma'am.
What did you say about salt?
The RDA is 2.4 grams of sodium. Salt restriction tries to keep it under 1.5. So a big reduction in salt is difficult if you're using prepared foods or if you go out to eat a lot where you have no control over what you're getting. So patients often find it difficult to stay on a salt restriction. Why is salt restriction useful? Turns out it enhances the effectiveness of the diuretics, and so the two things together reduce blood volume. Reduction in salt alone can reduce blood volume, but probably not enough to truly help. But it does enhance the action of the diuretics. When we think of afterload, what are we thinking about? The pressure against which the heart has to pump. So it's got to beat systolic pressure or the blood doesn't go anywhere. So systemic vascular resistance is increased in congestive heart failure. And so if your resistance gets too high, then what can happen to cardiac output? It just decreases. The heart can't pump against it. So we've got drugs that can reduce afterload. Alpha-1 blockers, vasodilating drugs, ACE inhibitors, beta blockers, a lot of things. Then we've got contractility issues. In congestive heart failure, contractility is typically reduced. There's decreased vigor of contraction. Stroke volume's usually decreased. So basically everything's down, so what do you want to do? You want to try to pick it back up. So positive inotropic drugs, like the cardiac glycosides, would be the major ones that are used here. There are others that are available for short-term use, but long-term oral therapy with the digoxin or the digitalis glycosides would be called for. And then reflex systems are changed. Yes, Nick? A cardiotonic steroid. Well, the cardiac glycosides do have a steroidal nucleus. Yep, so I guess you're using the same name. Okay. Baroreceptor set point changes in congestive heart failure. So it goes to a lower set point, lower sensitivity. Renin-angiotensin, we've already talked about, is activated. So when you think about it, what does a patient complain about? They're tired, they've got edema-related problems, breathing difficulties, they just can't seem to get going. So how can you treat acute heart failure? Say, especially after an MI. There are drugs that are available. Dobutamine, dopamine, given intravenously, are positive inotropes, increase heart output. And if you use the appropriate dose, you may not increase heart rate too much. So you can increase cardiac output without increasing cardiac work too much. Then we've got the phosphodiesterase inhibitors. And what does phosphodiesterase do? Turns out it chews up cyclic AMP. So it breaks down cyclic AMP. Why is that important? Cyclic AMP is important in increasing cardiac output because it's involved in the inotropic response mechanism. And how do your beta receptors function? They increase cyclic AMP levels. So if you can inhibit then cyclic AMP metabolism, then the cyclic AMP can work longer. So amrinone or milrinone are both available as phosphodiesterase inhibitors. They're given intravenously to help increase cardiac output. So one of the things you'll notice with these first four drugs that we've talked about, they're all given intravenously. They're all given in an institutional type setting. There is another agent that can be thrown in there as well, phenoldepam, to decrease blood pressure. Turns out this is a dopamine receptor agonist predominantly. So it's a D1 agonist. So acute heart failure. The inotropes are really used a lot. But what about congestive heart failure? Congestive heart failure can be treated in lots of different ways. So what we're going to end up doing is going through all of these different drugs at one point or another and try to deal with them and what they do. So when you think about this and you look at it, what are you seeing? You've got drugs that are definitely strongly affecting contractility, but others that have no effect there. You've got some that affect heart rate, some that affect afterload, preload, some that cause arrhythmia-type situations. So you got different drugs that are acting in different places, have different kinds of side effects, and so you can end up mixing drugs to produce the desired effect of increasing cardiac output while trying to minimize the downsides of these different classes of drugs. So with congestive heart failure, the average patient may be on 6 or 7 meds. And with an elderly patient who's got any kind of dementia-related problems, you can believe they mess up the meds quite a bit. And it becomes a problem area. Okay, so we'll kind of talk about this channel as we go through things. What is the first group of drugs we could talk about? Just very quickly, we'll go through the diuretics. What do you think the claim to fame of a diuretic is? It's real simple. You get rid of fluid. You get rid of sodium. So you're trying to reduce blood volume. So diuretics are the only agents in congestive heart failure that controls fluid retention. So if the patient has fluid-related problems, you've got to have a diuretic on board. So you decrease sodium and water retention, decrease blood volume, decrease preload. Now here's an important point. Diuretics can increase the effectiveness of ACE inhibitors and beta blockers. So now you've got a rational reason then for combining the ACE inhibitors or beta blockers with your diuretics. The first one there is thiazide, the thiazide diuretics. Where does it act in the tubule? The distal tubule. So it inhibits the sodium chloride cotransport in the distal tubule. It turns out that it also inhibits carbonic anhydrase in the proximal and distal tubules. You're going to have all this again later. But what does it do? It's an inhibitor of the sodium chloride cotransport in the distal tubule. And it has weak carbonic anhydrase inhibition in proximal and a little bit in the distal tubule. Carbonic anhydrase is most important in the proximal, though. Now, with the thiazides, thiazides are kind of interesting. When you first dose a patient on a thiazide diuretic, you get a reduction in blood volume. And then the body kind of gets used to the diuretic being on board, and blood volume gets back to where it's normally going to stay. And then you begin to see a reduction in blood pressure. So the blood pressure response is really not a function of the overall diuretic type response. So there's kind of something else going on, which there's a lot of hand waving as to how it happens. But the agents, the thiazides, are weak diuretics when compared to the next group, which is furosemide or a loop diuretic. So furosemide is a loop diuretic. It inhibits the sodium-potassium chloride transport system in the ascending limb of the loop of Henle. It inhibits the sodium-potassium chloride transport system in the ascending limb of the loop of Henle. So it's a loop diuretic. Big change in fluid volume, large diuresis. So these are stronger diuretics. So basically, some people think that when you have mild congestive heart failure and you're beginning to see some fluid overload, some edema, you just start them on a diuretic. And you can do that. The third diuretic that's listed is spironolactone. Now, spironolactone is kind of a different beast. It turns out it's a competitive inhibitor of the aldosterone receptor. So spironolactone, competitive inhibitor of the aldosterone receptor. So when we think about that, then aldosterone ordinarily triggers transcription and translation of a sodium-potassium exchanger in the collecting duct. And so if you inhibit that process, you get a reduction in sodium-potassium exchange in the collecting duct. Spironolactone is a potassium-sparing diuretic. Whereas the thiazides and the loops waste potassium. So we'll get into more details about the diuretics later. But you basically got two choices, really, in terms of getting fluid out. And that is, if there's a lot of fluid on board, most people go ahead and just start with a loop diuretic. But if you can get by with a weaker diuretic, then the thiazides become an option. Spironolactone's claim to fame is that it's a potassium-sparing diuretic and it's an aldosterone inhibitor. so it can help specifically reduce aldosterone-mediated changes. Okay, what about ACE inhibitors? ACE inhibitors are very important in the treatment of heart failure. They're beginning to take a greater and greater role, along with the ARBs, or the angiotensin II receptor blockers. There are a host of ACE inhibitors, only a few are given to you. What do they do? They block angiotensin converting enzymes, so they decrease the production of angiotensin II. Angiotensin II is one of the most potent vasoconstrictors in the body. So you decrease angiotensin II production and its vasoconstriction. Now, besides that, and ACE inhibitor is actually a kininase, and so by being inhibited, you block the breakdown of bradykinin. Turns out bradykinin is a nice vasodilator. So with the ACE inhibitors then, you decrease production of a vasoconstrictive agent, and you reduce elimination of a vasodilator substance. What's the net effect? Decrease preload, decrease afterload, decrease blood pressure, decreased aldosterone secretion. So the ACE inhibitors then, two big effects. They reduce production of angiotensin II and they reduce breakdown of bradykinin. We've also got the angiotensin II receptor blockers. These guys decrease angiotensin II function. They do not affect bradykinin levels. And so these three then have been approved for congestive heart failure. And we'll come back and get more details on the ACE inhibitors and the ARBs later. There is one important thing to remember with both of them. They should not be used in pregnancy because they're phototoxic. We'll get more side effects later. So the ARBs and the ACE inhibitors are phototoxic. Should not be used in pregnancy. Okay. Vasodilators once again show up in treatment of chronic congestive heart failure. But they show up because you need a little extra oomph for a couple of days to get a patient through an acute episode. And so you can use these guys out 2-3 days, but that really is about the limit of amrinone and milrinone. Increased cyclic AMP in the heart leads to increased calcium, so to a positive inotropic action. Increased cyclic AMP in vascular smooth muscle has a dilator response. So your vasodilators then have usefulness as well. There are some caveats that we'll add to those in a minute. Let's see, what else have we got? Dilators. So hydralazine is a big one. What do we know about hydralazine? This is an arteriolar vasodilator. So it acts directly on your arterioles to dilate. So we're going to have big reductions in afterload. This is a powerful vasodilator. So if you think of something that's going to have a powerful vasodilatory response, what's the problem? The reflex kicking in. So reflex, increased sympathetic nervous system, drive to the heart and to the periphery. So you increased heart rate, you increase contractility, increased, you try to increase constriction, but the vasodilator wins. And it turns out you also increase renin release. So when you think about hydralazine now, what's its biggest problem? The reflex tac. So rationally, how would you combine it with other drugs? So it makes sense with a beta blocker. Now you're treating congestive heart failure now. So you do know what you just said, right? Okay, beta blockers are used. They're just kind of screwy when you think about them. But yeah, so you can combine then hydralazine with beta blockers. You can actually give them with alpha blocking drugs. You can actually give them with diuretics. Hydralazine almost always will produce some flushing, a little headache, palpitations. But it's a potent arteriolar dilator. Okay. We can also talk about the nitrates again. You have a question, David?
Yeah, I don't understand. What are you saying about these problems?
If you get too much beta blocker on board, you block the sympathetic drive to the heart, you're blocking one of the compensatory mechanisms for treating heart failure. Beta blockers can precipitate heart failure. So it's kind of a paradoxical use. So you got to be careful. But they're used.
Why would you use that drug? There's so many other options to use on this. Why ever go that route?
Because they prevent remodeling, and we'll talk about that in a minute. Before we get there, let's talk about the nitrates again. What are the nitrates? These are venous vasodilators. So hydralazine and the nitrates are a little bit different. Kind of the side effect spectrum is about the same. You knock pressure way down, reflex tac becomes an issue, headache becomes an issue. But you get decrease preload, decrease afterload. You can have postural hypotension, reflex tac. And again, the biggest problem with it is its tolerance. The final group of vasodilators that we'll think about are the alpha-1 selective blockers. Prazosin, doxazosin, terazosin, and others. These guys decrease preload and afterload. They have minimum reflex tac. So you get some syncope on initial dosing. You remember what the other autonomic side effects were? Or is it too far from Wednesday yet to remember all that? Nasal congestion. You can have effects on GI tone and motility. So what's an alpha blocker going to do? So diarrhea. Let's see, what else we got with an alpha blocker? You can impair ejaculation. You can have syncope on initial dosing. Alpha blockers do lots of things. Okay. Now let's talk about beta blockers. Beta blockers, paradoxical use. One of the compensation mechanisms for a reduction in cardiac output is going to be hypertrophy. Yes, Sean. Syncope, fainting. So, you can have postural hypotension, you get up too fast and you faint. So one of the things that happens with congestive heart failure in the compensatory side is you increase the size of the heart, thinking more muscle cells, better force of contraction. But once you start getting hypertrophy, what happens? The efficiency of cardiac contraction goes downhill. The other thing that happens structurally is that the heart begins to lose its elongated and pointed shape and becomes more circular. With a more circular ventricle, then the effectiveness of emptying the ventricle on contraction goes downhill. So what do you want to do? Prevent that cardiac remodeling. Beta blockers do that. Does it have anything to do with beta blocking property? Probably not. So there is a paradoxical use. Some patients respond favorably to beta blockers because of reduced remodeling. The biggest study was done with metoprolol, or Lopressor. In this situation, they took patients that had class 2 or class 3 congestive heart failure. It decreased the risk of sudden death in their group. It decreased renin release. It decreased cardiac hypertrophy. It decreases automaticity in cardiac cells. So there are lots of positives associated with the beta blockers here. Decreased risk of sudden death, decreased renin release, decreased catecholamine-induced cardiac hypertrophy, and decreased automaticity of cardiac cells. So these were the four major positive outcomes associated with metoprolol use in a big study. Now then, was it a panacea? No. Why is that? Well, there were some risks associated with it. In some patients, you knock blood pressure down too far and they don't respond very well. So hypotension was considered a negative response. A little reduction in pressure is a good thing, but if it's too big, it's not. Exacerbation of heart failure, so it did make some patients worse. And beta blockers can cause heart block and bradycardia, so you do remove then part of the compensatory mechanism. So those were kind of the downsides to beta blockers.
Can you explain what heart block is?
Heart block, the conduction from SA node to the Hyspokinji system is prevented at the AV node. Sometimes people have ectopic foci that start beating, so the automaticity of the cells can give rise to an ectopic focus, and that's usually reduced. So there are positives associated with the beta blockers. There are negatives associated with the beta blockers. Now, some books will tell you, okay, start the patient on a diuretic and get the fluid balance, get rid of the edema. Then add on board an ACE inhibitor or an ARB. It makes good sense, and see how they're doing. If those two things stabilize out and the patient seems to be holding their own pretty well, but you're still not happy with the cardiac output that you're getting, You can then try a beta blocker and hopefully prevent remodeling. Some patients respond to beta blocker therapy. Some don't. Some take time to get used to all these drugs in their system. The other drugs that were studied were carvedilol, especially Coreg. Coreg was involved in a number of studies of congestive heart failure patients. There is not a good study that says that Coreg is better than labetalol, so having an alpha-beta blocker instead of just a beta blocker, you know, who knows? But some people prefer the Coreg over the metoprolol. But basically, you see the similar type results. So it's a paradoxical use. You think, okay, it has some good points, but there sure are some risks associated with it. But in many patients, it's not uncommon to start with the diuretic and the ACE inhibitor and then add the beta blocker on board and see if the patient will tolerate it. Things like hydralazine are going to be a later type drug added if you really need to get pressures down. All right. The last drug on that page is amiodarone. Amiodarone is a potassium channel blocker. We're going to talk about it again when we talk about class 3 antiarrhythmic drugs. So it has some usefulness as well because it can promote some vasodilation. Oh me. The last group of drugs that we've got on the list are digitalis glycosides, the cardiac glycosides. Cardiac glycosides all come from a nice, wonderful little plant that you can actually buy and have in your little home. They have pretty little flowers. This is Digitalis purpurea for purple flowers. There's a Digitalis lanata for white flowers. So it's the foxglove plant. One of the things that's interesting about digoxin is highlighted in that case history. In that particular case, as you read through it, this woman comes in, she's taking her normal dose of digoxin, they then measure her blood, and all of a sudden they find her blood level is at way too high for her to be asymptomatic. She ought to be throwing arrhythmias like crazy at that blood level. You might say, well, why? What's going on? It turns out that with the cardiac glycosides, they have a very delayed alpha phase. And if you look at digoxin, it has a half-life of 36 hours. So when you draw a typical curve for it, you get a really flat situation. So if you start with oral dosing, it goes up, and then you've got a really slow alpha phase before it goes into the elimination or beta phase. So this is kind of exaggerated. You know, most of the time we think of things coming down like this. And so if you're going to order, and you will, blood levels of cardiac glycosides to make sure your patients aren't in a toxic range, because it's a drug with a narrow therapeutic index, if you get a blood value that's totally screwball, it may be that the blood was drawn at the wrong time, and it was because you were up here on the alpha phase and you weren't measuring down here. And that's essentially what was done. I think the rule of thumb is you dose in the morning and you draw your bloods around 4 in the afternoon. Now, don't quote me on that, but I think that's what it is. So you really wait, I guess, is the point. Now, since some people asked about this, some people like structures. This is your cardiac glycoside. It does have an aglycone, so in other words, no sugars on here. It is of a steroidal nature. There's a lactone ring out there, and then coming off the 3-hydroxy or digitoxose sugar residues. And so this beastie could be called digoxygenin tridigitoxose. You didn't want to know that, did you? Forget it, it's digoxin. But it has all these sugars out here. It is a steroid nucleus. This is much more fun to look at. Anyhow, like I said, I shouldn't have shown that to you. There are two major cardiac glycosides that are used clinically. In the United States, the one that you will know is digoxin or linoxin. The second one was taken off the U.S. market, and that's digitoxin. It is available as an orphan drug for, I think, ovarian cancer and something else. But it's available in Europe as a cardiac glycoside. What are the two differences between them? Digoxin has a half-life of about 36 hours. Digitoxin has a half-life of 5 to 7 days. It undergoes enterohepatic cycling. And so actually, if you look at that sugar residue, one of those sugars gets glucuronidated, and as soon as it gets into the gut, glucuronide gets pulled off, it gets reabsorbed and goes back and goes through enterohepatic cycling. So digitoxin has a very long half-life. Anyhow, so the main one that you need to remember is digoxin or linoxin. What's its mechanism? Well, there are four. Obviously, you know the first one. So it's an inhibitor of sodium potassium ATPase in the heart. If you inhibit sodium potassium ATPase, you get more sodium sticking around in the cell. If you got more sodium sticking around in the cell, what do? You end up raising calcium levels. More calcium now sticking around in the cell, you get a positive effect on contraction, so a greater contractile response. So with an inhibition of sodium potassium ATPase, you get your inotropic response. With an increase in cardiac output, what happens? You can actually increase GFR. You can actually promote a diuresis, decreasing blood volume, reducing then total fluid volume, reducing the amount of fluid coming back to the heart, reducing the stimulus for hypertrophy. So the cardiac glycoside, just on this one action, has some very strong use. But in addition to that, it turns out that it increases vagal tone, so you can get a decrease in heart rate from that, so it helps reduce sympathetic overdrive, if you will. It sensitizes vagal efferents to reset the baroreceptors. Again, this helps to reduce sympathetic overdrive. And then it's an inhibitor of renal sodium potassium ATPase. And so it promotes a diuretic response from that. And it'll decrease renin release. So when you think about it, you've got inhibition of sodium potassium ATPase in the heart, more calcium around, greater force of contraction. With an increase in cardiac output then, you can facilitate renal function so that you can promote a diuresis that way, but you also inhibit the sodium potassium ATPase in the tubular system. That ends up then facilitating diuresis as well. Net effect is you're beginning to get rid of excess fluid, you're reducing renin release. The other two mechanisms have to do with an increased vagal drive to the heart and resetting of the baroreceptors so that basically sympathetic overdrive is reduced. So cardiac glycosides have a complex mechanism for how they do what they do. But they are very good at doing what they do. So if we look at this next figure, well, the 4 points are there. We're going to talk about that later. They interact basically at the level of protein binding. So the question was major interactions with verapamil and quinidine. Protein binding is one. They compete in the tubule for reabsorption. All right. So basically, you should be able to go through this figure and figure this figure out. Go figure, right? So here we got a typical Starling curve again, output versus end diastolic pressure. Here's the normal curve. Here's the patient that's normal. You see the reduction as a result of heart failure. At this point, you're decompensated, but if the body tries to compensate for it, you can push it, say, out to where point C is, just by enhancing sympathetic drive to the heart and that sort of thing. But then if you give digitalis, you can actually shift things higher toward the normal side of the curve because you've increased contractility, you've increased force of contraction, you've increased cardiac output now. So for the same end diastolic pressure, you get greater output. And then as other effects of the digitalis take a more important role, you can then shift this thing back toward greater output with even shorter fiber lengths. So less work on the heart then. So the cardiac glycosides act in a lot of different ways to enhance cardiac output and reduce the amount of work that the heart is having to do to achieve that goal. Okay. So is that clear? Everybody understand all that? Good. I'm not going to finish this. I've run out of steam. Anybody want to stop? Tim? This meeting, this class is meeting tomorrow at the hospital, yes, from 10 to 12. The quiz will be over